Hi, everyone. Thank you for being here. Welcome to Brookings and to the launch of our Pakistan Index Project, which is now available on the web, as well as a general discussion of the Pakistan and Afghanistan indices and the debates about metrics in these two important ongoing parts of the world, and the broader policy questions that surround the metrics debate. I'm Mike O'Hanlon, and will be moderating today. And I've had the good fortune of being involved in all three of our index projects, starting with Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Pakistan. But Jeremy Shapiro is the lead senior scholar on the Afghanistan index, and he will speak later. Jason Campbell has been a crucial part of all three of the indices and has spent much of the last few months essentially building the Pakistan index, and we're very grateful, therefore, to have him part of the panel. And then rounding things out will be two of not only our best Pakistan minds, but the nation's best Pakistan experts, Bruce Rydell and Steve Cohen. And so how we'll proceed is that I'll just say a few more words here about how we think about these metric projects in general terms, and then we'll turn things over to Jason, who again understands the Pakistan index very well, having created it. And then Bruce and Steve will speak about Pakistan more generally, and they're free to talk about metrics within the Pakistan debate or not as they see fit. I'm sure you'll all bring them back to metrics in the discussion if they don't spend a lot of time on it in presentations. But we're not trying to confine the conversation today to only the metrics issue. We do, however, want to begin from that. And then Jeremy Shapiro will speak about Afghanistan. And again, the metrics debate there being so hot and so topical, we didn't feel it made any sense to talk about quantitative indicators of progress in major stabilization efforts these days without involving Afghanistan and the Afghanistan index as well. Let me also say, by way of general introduction, that we remain deeply indebted to our friends in Norway for a great deal of support for the Afghanistan index, and we are very grateful to a friend, Mala Gunkar, for helping us create the Pakistan index. And we also are involving a broader group of people in both of these projects, but especially now the Pakistan index, than just Brookings individuals. We alone are responsible and accountable and, of course, to be blamed for mistakes. But we have a number of Pakistani friends who are already aware of this project and will be providing us with further ideas, insights, sources, and critiques, we're sure, and we hope, in the coming days. So to the extent that people see this as an effort to assess progress, and the grades will not always be glowing, that's done in the spirit of academic discourse and trying to provide information on important policy debates rather than as any attempt by Brookings to act like the next government accountability office in critiquing the aid program towards Pakistan or Pakistan itself. This is more about information, and we're actually trying to create a bit of a bilateral but informal working process with a number of Pakistani colleagues in the ensuing weeks and months. Again, it's blame us if you see things you don't like, but please be aware that we will continue to be reaching out and hope very much to have that spirit of inclusivity. Let me say a couple of words now about methodology and about what these databases are all about. And maybe one way to do it, and I do apologize for taking a little time here in the introduction, but I think it's important to give you a little spirit of what we're trying to do with these projects. We recognize that metrics are often used and abused in policy debates. And certainly anyone who remembers the lessons of Vietnam, where we had metrics like body counts and the so-called crossover rate, we thought if we killed enough Viet Cong, regardless of sort of almost how well we did it or how many people might also be caught in the crosshairs in the process, that ultimately the Viet Cong would not be able to recruit enough followers to sustain themselves. That would be a pathway towards victory. It was an incorrect assumption. It was a bad metric, and it was certainly bad to think of that as the predominant metric. And I would argue it led us to tactics that were actually counterproductive in the war. So metrics can be abused, and we're fully aware of that in constructing these indices today, which is one of the reasons why we try to have a fairly broad range of indicators so that we don't overly narrow down or claim more precision in the process than is possible. We leave it to you, the users of the indices, and sometimes to ourselves, if we put on a different hat and become analysts, to have a debate about which metrics are most important, most indicative. But we do not try to be overly narrow with a short list of quantitative indicators ourselves because we're aware of the lessons of history that suggest that one needs to avoid that. There are a few other points of sort of warning, you know, user's guides for how not to make mistakes in using these indices that I'm sure will come up in the conversations today. But let me also just mention one more now and then turn to our panelists. And that is that there is a temptation sometimes to measure what's easily measurable and talk about what's easily quantifiable. And we have to be careful about thinking we've figured out which metrics really are the most important or indicative or telling of the progress of a war or a stabilization mission just because they are things that we can somehow associate with a nice reference or a nice source of data. And again, we're very attentive to that. Jason and I have been working very hard on the Pakistan Index, Jason and Jeremy on the Afghanistan Index, to try to, again, broaden the horizon and look for information where it may not always be easy to find or totally reliable or totally precise, but nonetheless where it's important not to fool ourselves into thinking that we have the right answer just because we have the right five indicators that can somehow be well documented. As an example, as I wrap up here, in Iraq, for a long time we thought that the more Iraqi soldiers we trained, the better off we'd be. Turns out Steve Biddle was right. Other scholars were right who warned that, in fact, we were not doing a very good job training the Iraqi security forces, and we were effectively preparing them for a civil war, which they later held in a way that involved some of the very people in the security forces that we had helped train, because we couldn't easily measure political reliability and the purging of militia influence in many of these groups. And so trying to track what was easy to track, number of people put through basic training, number of rifles conveyed to people in units in the field, was not actually the best way to understand the progress. We're aware of this. We hope your questions and your comments will continue to explore some of these kinds of issues. And the Pakistan Index, like others here, will be a work in progress where your input is appreciated and where we are aware of the need to keep improving things. So with that long wind-up, and I appreciate your patience, but those were some important methodological points that I needed to get off my chest, we will turn things over to Jason. And I will say that in the Pakistan Index, there are security indicators, economic indicators, and politics slash governance slash public opinion indicators. So those three bins of data, just like we've had with the other two projects here. And there are some very interesting and sometimes counterintuitive trends that emerge. I'll let him talk about what some of those may be. And we can also then go back to that in discussion. So without further ado, after a lot of ado, let me now ask Jason to please go ahead and tell us about this project. And again, thank you, Jason, for your effort, and congratulations on what you've put together.
Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you all for being here this afternoon. I think to begin, it's worthwhile to briefly mention a few important ways in which this particular index project is unique from what we've done thus far with regards to Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the most important distinction is that unlike Iraq and Afghanistan, Pakistan is not currently battling an insurgency while simultaneously trying to rebuild a national bureaucracy. So comparatively speaking, Pakistan has greater institutional capacity to the broad range of issues that can help foster greater stability. So I think, again, in comparison with what we've done with Iraq and Afghanistan, as Mike alluded to in his opening statements, we are going forward working with Pakistani officials and scholars in trying to shape and mold this into a project that they can hopefully be able to optimize the utility with. Another important distinction is that there is a much more minimal American presence in Pakistan, obviously, and due to that, the reporting of key metrics that we rely on in Afghanistan and Iraq that come from places like the Department of Defense or the State Department simply aren't there from the same sources. So we've had to rely more on the Pakistani government statistics, reports put out by their much more robust NGO community, some of their media reports. So there's a sort of a unique angle with regard to where we're getting this data. And worth mentioning that everything we do use is cited in endnotes in the back. So you'll see that just glancing over it, a lot more of the data we use is coming from non-American sources. So finally, looking at some of the broad takeaways, as Mike said, with regards to the security, economic, and political issues, I think the utility of this project is that you can see in a number of fairly comprehensive pages that there is no coincidence that there is a strong correlation between insecurity and a lack of economic opportunity or development, particularly when you're able to drill down to a regional or a provincial level, which we are able to do in most cases here, which is, from our experience, always the best way to do it when you can drill down at least to the provincial level. And I think it goes without saying that in the areas where you see the least security, keeping at the provincial level, the Northwest Frontier Province, Fatah, Balochistan, it's no coincidence that these areas, by and large, have the lowest literacy rates, the lowest employment rates, poor access to health care, poor availability of potable water and sewage, poor freedom of movement. And intuitively it makes sense, but it's also helpful when you can show it quantitatively. And hopefully over time we'll be able to show that an improvement or a decrease in some of these non-direct issues that all contribute to stability will be able to see some sort of an effect on regional insecurity. One thing I would like to highlight, too, is that the Pakistani government has shown recently, I think, an increased recognition that sustainable stability is going to require a more broad approach that goes beyond some of the more typical security measures. One in particular thing over the last couple of years, they've been able to form more forward-looking and far-reaching provincial development plans with dedicated budgets that go out 7 to 10 years with a much more greater focus on a lot of quality of life issues like education, like employment, and a host of others. And we were able to highlight that a little bit in the index, particularly with regard to Fatah, which is an area that has been, I think, most neglected over the years. Another area where at a more broad national level they've started to look at more is spending on education. Much of the past decade they've devoted only around 2% or so of GDP per year to education spending, which is about half of what UNESCO recommends countries to spend, about 4%. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Pakistani cabinet signed off on a very ambitious plan to increase government spending on education to 7% by the year 2015. So you are seeing signs of improved recognition that a lot of the non-direct security issues need to be addressed to foster greater stability. If I could just say a word, too, on the last component Mike mentioned, and that's public opinion polling, which we find is very important in these studies. It allows us to transpose some of the hard data we look at onto how it's affecting public perception. And ultimately, a counterinsurgency is not going to be successful unless you're addressing the issues of the public. So just real quickly here, broadly speaking, while public perception cannot be considered at this point good, there are signs that it's less bad than it's been in past years. More respondents in a poll this past spring, about 40%, said that they feel safer now than they did a year ago. Back in the fall, only about 20% of the people said they felt safer. We're also seeing a slight uptick in those who feel that they are better off economically than they were a year ago, although that's still fairly modest. One very important data point with regard to the polling, there's been a dramatic shift in support for the presence of the Pakistani Taliban or Al-Qaeda in just recent months. From the fall of 2007 to this past spring, the number of respondents who classified the activities of local Taliban insurgents and Al-Qaeda as a critical threat to Pakistan has more than doubled and sits at currently about just over 80%. Support for the suicide bombings and other acts of violence against civilians in order to fight the enemies of Islam. 90% in a recent poll said that that is never justified. Only back in 2005, only about 42% said such acts of violence on the public is never justified. So you're seeing the public collectively move against its support for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Nevertheless, this has not corresponded to a greater support for the U.S. government. Pakistan has been one country that has remained effectively Obama-proof here in the last year, as the most recent poll shows that about 60% of Pakistanis have a very unfavorable opinion of the U.S. government, whereas just last fall it was only about 40%. So we're seeing an increased tension in public opinion of the U.S. Just in closing here, a couple of quick sort of observations here. I think given this lack of support for the U.S., it's imperative that the U.S. remains cognizant of these sensitivities and when concerning outside intervention, and continue to provide assistance in ways that minimize political blowback to those who we're trying to help. And as far as the Pakistani government goes with regards to our efforts here, one important thing they've started to do in the last few years is to separate Fatah as a separate entity with unique issues that need to be addressed, which is certainly an important step forward. And traditionally hasn't been the case. You look at historical data, and Fatah is usually lumped in with the NWFP, the Northwest Frontier Province, as one single entity when it comes to a host of government statistics over time. And I think it's important to be able to discern some of the issues that make Fatah unique and be able to judge the improvement. And one important step was just a couple of years ago, the Pakistani government issued a very broad-reaching Fatah development plan that goes over 10 years. And not only is it important that it establishes the goals for that region, but it also presents a baseline from which to judge that progress. So it was only back in, again, 2006 where we really had good data to begin a baseline from which to judge progress. You go prior to that, and it's very tough to disaggregate that from the NWFP. So I would certainly encourage that to continue.
Before we go to Bruce, Jason, just a couple of clarifying questions, and thank you for a very good presentation that lays out the basic approach of the indices and the different parts of the country that you're looking at. Do you see any change in trends in the security environment? You mentioned public opinion polling and
right.
People being a little less fatalistic about their security environment, even though they still say it's pretty bad. But do you see any actual data that signifies whether the situation on the ground is better or worse? And then secondly, do you see any data yet that allows you to assess whether any improvement is going on in those northwest areas in terms of the building, what we call the building phase in the counterinsurgency literature, the idea of improved access to healthcare, education, it's, these sorts of things, or is it just too early yet to know?
Well, with regard to your first question, I think one interesting indicator here is to watch is displacement. One thing that a policy that the Pakistani Army has adopted here in going into the places of the Northwest Frontier Province, like Swat, is that they're going in and informing the public to leave the area, and something that they haven't traditionally done, from what I've been able to see. So that's an indicator of where. You're about to see a certain level of instability. We're seeing it now in South Waziristan to a certain extent, which has seen much greater displacement recently. But it's so fluid. I mean, you get daily updates now on the number of families being either newly displaced or repatriated back into their district. So I found that to be, a bit muddled and difficult to follow, given that it's a day-by-day basis. But it is, again, in my limited research, been a decent indicator of the situation on the ground when you look at a district-by-district level. With regard to some of the building efforts of the Pakistani military, it's early to say now, although I have seen reports in recent weeks, some causes for concern, particularly in the Swat Valley. There have been a lot of reports of some extrajudicial killings being carried out by some of the Pakistani security forces. Of suspected Taliban insurgents or sympathizers, And again, it's largely anecdotal at this point, but there have been numerous reports of families of these people claiming that they had nothing to do with the Taliban, and I think that's certainly something that could help to limit some of the security successes they've had there. So that's the one data point I have, but it's unfortunately one in more favor of being concerned rather than having another good story to tell.
Thank you. As you all know, Bruce Riedel has spent much of his career in the intelligence world looking at South Asia writ large, and wrote a book that was published last year by Brookings, The Search for Al-Qaeda, is writing currently on Pakistan, and chaired the President's Task Force on Afghanistan-Pakistan policy earlier this year. So we are thrilled to have him here as well. Bruce, over to you.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for the very nice introduction. I'd like to pick up where Jason has left off here and do a kind of progress report, status report, on Pakistan's war against terrorism. How well is Pakistan doing? Not surprisingly, the bottom line is a mixed picture. You wouldn't expect it to be either all positive or all negative. But I think one thing that is significant to note here is that we're seeing some evidence of some significant progress. Compared to a year ago, 2 years ago, there is more positive indicators than we would have seen before. Now, it's very dangerous in this environment to claim victory or to suggest that somehow we've turned a significant corner. I would suggest that much of the progress we've seen is very tenuous at best, could easily be reversed, but nonetheless, it's important to look at. First, just to put the facts into perspective, how big a problem do we have? The National Counterterrorism Center, which is the official U.S. repository of counting terrorism and which has a fairly rigorous methodology for doing so, reported that in 2007 there were 890 incidents of terror in Pakistan. In 2008, it rose to 1,839. Now, one can quibble over the 39, the 40, and stuff like that, but the general trend, I think, is very easy to see. And anyone who watches the news or even pays a little bit of attention to Pakistan can see that this problem is growing and becoming worse every day. We don't have numbers for 2009, but I think it's safe to say that the pace of incidents is even faster in 2009 than it was in 2008. If you look at where those incidents occurred, what's also striking is the geographical disbursement. Yes, 60% of them take place in the Northwest Frontier Province and the federally administered tribal areas, but a good 40% of them take place outside of there, and a significant number of them now taking place in the Punjab, the heartland of Pakistan. Now, these levels are unprecedented. We've not seen this kind of violence in Pakistan before. We have seen it localized in parts of Pakistan before. Certainly, Karachi earned its nickname back in the 1980s and 1990s as a terrorist capital of the world, but we haven't seen it spread across the country like we have here. So what's the positive news? Well, Jason's already referred to it, the Army's offensive in the Swat Valley. There were many naysayers about this offensive when it began, many who said that the internally displaced persons would never go back to their homes, that the Taliban wouldn't be rooted out, that this was all going to be theater and not much reality. And there are disturbing parts to what's gone on in the Swat Valley. There's no question that there seems to be some extrajudicial killing. There seems to be a lack of accountability in some of these operations. But putting all that aside, I think it's unquestionable that we've seen here the first major military operation by the Pakistani government in almost a decade against a serious terrorist insurgent force. And we've seen significant casualties in this operation. The Pakistani army has put out a bewildering variety of statistics about exactly how many casualties took place, but one of them is quite revealing that came out over the last several days, which indicates somewhere around 5,000 dead Pakistani soldiers and 10,000 wounded over the course of the last couple of years, the vast majority of them being in the SWAT operation. The Pakistani military would help itself, and I would argue would help the Pakistan Index immeasurably, if it would be more precise about these kinds of numbers. Now, of course, this operation was also greatly facilitated by an operation carried out by the United States government, the CIA drone attack that killed Bitatullah Massoud. It was a U.S. operation, but done in close coordination with Pakistan. More importantly, the Pakistani intelligence services were very quick to follow up on the drone attack and divide and seek to create confusion and dissension within the Pakistan Taliban in the weeks afterwards. They used classic tactics of counterterrorism, of trying to pit one group against another, and they had a fair amount of success. If you don't believe it, look at the eulogy that Ayman Zawahiri put out last week about Bitatullah Massoud. He drones on for the better part of an hour talking about what a great loss it is to have this man martyred. If South Waziristan is indeed next, that would be a significant move. For my part, I'll wait and see before I believe it. Combined with these operations, of course, have been the CIA drone attacks against the Al-Qaeda presence in Pakistan over the last 9 months. Here again, the data is hard to get your hands on. And even those people inside the intelligence community who know more about it than anyone else will tell you they're never really sure just how effective a drone operation is. But overall, I think it is safe to say that more pressure is being put on Al-Qaeda's safe haven in Pakistan today than at any time since 2003 and 2004. Again, look at the complaints that you're hearing from Al-Qaeda. Ayman Zawahiri and bin Laden have both been quite public this year in saying that they're under pressure and that they're under pressure from these attacks as well as from the Pakistani army. Nonetheless, no one should have any illusions that Al-Qaeda doesn't remain deadly and still alive. The court case involving the Afghan-American in Denver should be a wake-up call to all of us that Al-Qaeda is still looking for operatives who will carry out operations in the United States. The Pakistani Army's actions in Swat, and hopefully its forthcoming operations in Waziristan, benefit from significant popular support. Jason's already alluded to this. The polling data in Pakistan this year is really quite interesting. Now, polling data in any country has to be taken with a grain of salt. Polling data in a country where large parts of the population are illiterate should be taken with an even bigger grain of salt. But we now have a significant number of polls, all of which basically show the same thing. A very significant blowback against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and extremist tactics and jihadist tactics in Pakistan. There's a new International Republican Institute poll that was released just this weekend. I don't think it's on our index yet. It will need to get up there soon. It shows that 90% of Pakistanis agree that these extremists threaten the survival of the Pakistani state. 69% supported the Pakistani army offensive in the Swat Valley. 86% agree that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in particular are a threat to their interests and to their security. The data, though, as Jason also alluded to, also suggests very strong opposition to U.S. policies. Asked should Pakistan cooperate with the United States, 80% say no. Only 18% say yes. That's up from 61% saying no in March of 2009. One has to draw the conclusion that the drone operations also have their negative downside in terms of Pakistani public opinion. If that's the positive side of the lecture, what's on the negative side? I think we have to point in particular at two problems. One is the problem of the Afghan Taliban. While the Pakistani army has been willing to take on the Pakistan Taliban, it is yet to make it clear where it stands on the Afghan Taliban. Mullah Omar may or may not be in Quetta, he may or may not be in Baluchistan, but what's clear is he's still operating, rather openly and rather effectively. His henchmen, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Haqqani, same thing. Whether they're on the Pakistani side of the border or the Afghan side of the border, they seem to move back and forth, and they seem to move back and forth largely with impunity. Mullah Omar, interestingly, is very, very clear not to associate himself with the Pakistani Taliban and not to criticize the government of Pakistan for its operations. In his annual Eid message this year, and that's basically his State of the Union message, it's also usually one of two or three messages he gives in the whole year, so the Eid message is basically the message you're going to get from Mullah Omar. He went on at great length to promise that when the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan is back in power in Kabul, it will respect the sovereignty and territorial independence of its neighbors. He didn't say Pakistan in particular, but he had seemed to be trying to go out of his way to make sure he didn't irritate anyone on the Pakistani side of the border. Of course, General McChrystal's report is much more clear-cut on this and quite explicit in saying that the Afghan Taliban continues to operate out of Quetta and, takes a step further, that it enjoys at least the passive, if not the active, support of some elements of the Pakistani establishment. The second area where there's still a lot to be done, in fact, almost nothing has been done, deals with Lashkar-e-Taiba, the group responsible last year for the attack on Mumbai. A handful of Lashkar-e-Taiba operatives may go on trial. Every time they're actually supposed to meet in trial, the judge postpones it again, so we don't know if there ever will be a real trial. But that's really missing the whole point. There has been no systematic crackdown on Lashkar-e-Taiba and its fellow associates like Jash Mohammed and their terrorist infrastructure since last November. The New York Times had a very good piece on this just a week ago. Indeed, Lashkar-e-Taiba's development side, Jamaat al-Dawah, was one of the major operatives working with IDPs in the Swat Valley. So in effect, the Pakistani state with one hand was swiping some jihadists. With the other hand, it was encouraging another group of jihadists. The leadership of Lashkar-e-Taiba remains free, remains quite vocal, quite active. According to very well-reported press stories, recruitment for Lashkar-e-Taiba is booming, and fundraising is doing very well. Why? Mumbai. People tend to join terrorist organizations which look like they're successful. Why not some more serious crackdown? I think it can be summed up in one word. It's a family affair. Lashkar-e-Taiba, unlike the Pakistan Taliban, is a Punjabi group. It recruits from the same basic families as the Pakistani army recruits into. Breaking down on Lashkar-e-Taiba would be far more difficult for any government in Pakistan, and so far we haven't seen it. The bottom line, another mass casualty attack along the scale of Mumbai could come at any time. The capability is there, the will is there, and I would suggest to you another mass casualty attack along the lines of Mumbai could quickly be a game changer for the situation in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Last point before I conclude, what's the U.S. role in all of this? Well, I would suggest to you the U.S. role is important, but largely incidental. U.S. encouragement, U.S. pressure, U.S. hand-wringing, U.S. jawboning probably encouraged the Pakistani establishment and the Pakistani army to do what it's done in Swat. It certainly has been useful in encouraging intelligence exchanges against al-Qaeda, but at the end of the day, the government of Pakistan did these things because it's in Pakistan's national interest, and in particular in the survival instincts of the Zardari government and its current relationship with the Pakistani army. The focus here has been on threats to the government of Pakistan, not on the threats to U.S. or NATO interests in the region or the larger threat posed by Lashkar-e-Taiba and its posture towards India.
Thank you very much, Bruce. A little more cheerful than we've sometimes heard you speak about Pakistan, but no one's jumping with joy yet either. And my guest, Steve, you've written just such great stuff on Pakistan over the years. Anybody who hasn't yet read Steve's Brookings book on Pakistan, in addition to having perhaps the best cover in the history of Brookings Press, has a fantastic set of contents, is a great history, but also explanation of what drives Pakistan culturally, historically, militarily, and otherwise. Steve's been sounding the warning calls about some of the needs to pay attention to this relationship for a long time. He's been, I know, very concerned about recent developments. I'm wondering if you're feeling a little better or at least giving a mixed verdict or if you're still fundamentally quite concerned, Steve, about how you see the country going.
Thank you, Mike. Let me congratulate you and Jason for the index. Can you hear me? The index. And I think I can summarize my views building on what Bruce said.
A little bit louder?
Yeah.
No, it's okay.
Just
no,
kick
it's
okay.
In.
Yeah, it's
good. Yeah, okay. I think I could summarize my views. I used to be short-term pessimistic and short-term and long-term pessimistic about Pakistan. Now I'm short-term optimistic and long-term pessimistic about Pakistan. I think that, and that's the subject of my next research project, I think that Pakistan is crippled by a series of bad decisions, not only those made in Pakistan, but by decisions made in the United States and other countries, in that it suffers from a really, really decayed, broken-down educational system. Its economy is dysfunctional. Sectarian violence that is within Islamic groups continues unabated. Islamist terrorism of various kinds is growing. And there's regional separatism on the march. That's all bad news. And whether those factors will bring Pakistan down in the future, I don't know. But one of my next research projects is to try and answer that question as best we can. The problem with polls and with data and with metrics is it doesn't offer the answers to these kinds of questions, but it does tell you where you've been. It's sort of like a rearview mirror. When I was a professor 1,000 years ago, we used to tell our graduate students that the trouble with quantitative data is that it's like the drunk who loses his keys. He only looks where the lampposts are shining light. That's because where the data is. So if you only look where the data is, you may not find your keys. If you only look where the poll data is and the other quantitative data, you may not find answers to your questions. To me, the most difficult questions, answers to the most difficult questions, aren't obtained by metrics. And I think the administration, it was really the Kerry-Lugar bill, the Biden-Lugar bill, was wrong in ordering the government to come up with metrics. You know, if Congress orders the administration to develop metrics, the administration will provide thousands and thousands of metrics, more than anybody wants. And I've seen one list, and really there were more objectives than metrics. I'm very skeptical of the idea of using quantitative data to measure, either to measure progress or whether we can get the right data to indicate what's happening in a country such as Pakistan. To me, the most difficult issue is tapping into the attitudes and the beliefs of Pakistani leaders themselves. And I've been told every time I speak on Pakistan, which has been quite frequent, that isn't it true that the Pakistan Army Officer Corps is more radical? And the answer is no. There's no data to prove that one way or the other. There's no evidence of any sort. What is happening, we're pretty sure, is that as Pakistan becomes more conservative, the officer corps becomes more conservative. But that doesn't mean that the officers who rise to the top are necessarily more conservative. So the widespread assumption here and in a lot of other countries that the officer corps is more conservative is probably not true. At best, it's unproven. And that's true, I think, of attitudes towards Pakistani youth, attitudes of Pakistani youth. Nobody's ever examined the subject, yet the assumption is that the madrasas are churning out thousands and thousands of radicalized Pakistani kids who then go off to become suicide bombers. Some studies show that, in fact, the suicide bombers do not come from the madrasas. They come from other directions. So I think that there are more difficult questions out there than I think the data can provide answers to. Coming up with a metric like this or a series of data is useful in that it tells you what you don't know. It may tell us a little bit about whether Pakistanis feel more secure or not, but most of the polling has not broken down Pakistan by province or by educational background. In other words, it's practically useless. I've been involved in some of the polling, studying some of the polls, and if you don't break it down by province or by educational or social background, it's virtually useless. In fact, I've done polling myself when I was a graduate student, I hate to confess this, and we simply made up most of the data. That's why when you drive around Chicago, if the freeways don't go where you want them to go, I can tell you why. So I think that this approach has its merits, often in terms of crude data showing you what might or might not be happening, but they also have the risk. And I think if governments, as we did during Vietnam, take it too seriously and don't have people on the ground actually with regional expertise, they're liable to lead you astray. One final point really is that the polls don't tell you, or these metrics don't tell you, whether Afghanistan is more important than Pakistan, or Pakistan is more important than Afghanistan, or whether they're the same degree of importance. And they don't tell you whether Pakistan's future is going to be shaped by India, by the United States, by other countries. In other words, these are tough policy choices where the metrics play virtually no role in guiding it. Let me stop at that point.
Well, thank you, Steve. And you set up Jeremy very nicely by mentioning the words Afghanistan a few times. And let me say, by way of introduction for my good friend and colleague Jeremy Shapiro, that he has increasingly become one of the country's great experts on Afghanistan. He was part of General McChrystal's strategic assessment team this summer. He's been to the country, I think, four or five times at this point, studied it from the point of view of NATO, which is sort of his traditional portfolio, but also as a military analyst and as a student of counterinsurgency. I've been lucky enough, along with Jason, to write some studies with him on how we use this kind of information in these kinds of wars to assess progress. And so I look forward very much, now that he's got a year of the Afghanistan Index under his belt as well, to hearing his thoughts about how Afghanistan looks at the moment when metrics are being elevated even more prominently, because as you know, the administration has recently been delivering metrics to the Congress to help figure out how we assess progress there. And they've taken at least one of our ideas to heart, and they dumped something like 46 metrics on the Congress. So figure you drown them in enough data, they won't be able to make any sense of it. That's one cynical interpretation of what they've done. The other interpretation is they're avoiding an excessive precision in claiming they know which three or four things really tell the direction of the war. Maybe Jeremy can answer which of these two interpretations is more accurate. In any event, I look forward, as do everyone else here, to your comments.
Thanks, Mike. I'm not going to touch that one, though. It's nice to follow up Stephen Bruce. It's a rare opportunity for me to sound uplifting. And I think what I wanted to do, instead of sort of focusing on the overall picture in Afghanistan, is to use it and use what we've learned over the last year or so as a little bit of a case study in the utility and limits of metrics, sort of expanding on Steve's point about why you shouldn't listen to us too much. I think the big sort of metric story, clearly, when you look at the papers these days in Afghanistan, is the U.S. and coalition military casualties, which was highlighted, of course, last week by the deaths of 8 soldiers in one incident. And it's obviously a very important indicator of progress, particularly, of course, because of its effects on the home fronts in the U.S. and Europe. And the increases in military casualties are very large. There were 360 coalition casualties through September of this year, which is roughly a 50% increase in the same period last year, and it's more than the 294 that there were for all of last year. But part of what we try to do in the index is to assess the strategy on its own terms, to try to figure out what the strategy is actually trying to accomplish and measure that. And if we look at the McChrystal report, which helpfully I helped write, so it's easy to see, it says that military casualties will go up in the short term as more troops come into Afghanistan and as they implement the strategy of protecting the population. What McChrystal did to realize this was to introduce new tactics, which to reduce civilian casualties caused by what they term pro-government forces, which is essentially the coalition and Afghan army forces, especially to reduce civilian casualties caused by airstrikes. In essence, what this was intended to do was to take more risk with coalition military lives to protect Afghan civilian lives. So they are now slower to call in airstrikes when troops are in contact, and that's been a big cause both of the increase in coalition military casualties. There is enormous focus on this issue from General McChrystal and from the ISAF command in general, where they say now that the most dangerous place in Afghanistan is standing in front of General McChrystal trying to explain a civilian casualty incident. There are some early indications in our numbers that these efforts have been very effective in reducing civilian casualties. Indeed, more effective than I would have thought possible, particularly in the context of an increasing number of troops over the last year. There were, according to the UN, there have been 1,388 civilian casualties through August of this year versus 1,482 at this point last year. And this hides, of course, that the decreasing trend started after January or February of this year. And every month since then has seen fewer civilian casualties than the year before. Probably more importantly than this, the cause of civilian casualties has started to become from overwhelmingly from insurgent-started violence. Last year, 39% of civilian casualties were caused by pro-government forces, principally by airstrikes, as I said. This year, it's just 21%, and decreasing in that percentage is decreasing throughout the year. August is always the deadliest month in Afghanistan, but only 7% of the civilian casualties in August were caused by pro-government forces. This, in terms of ISAF strategy, represents the green shoots of a fairly major counterinsurgency success. It means that the coalition is becoming the protector of the population, the insurgents are becoming the killers of the population, principally through IEDs and suicide bombings, which have become far less discriminate. And it accounts, in part, for the inability of the insurgents to profit from the decreasing popularity of the government. The insurgent support within the population remains very mired at a 5 to 10% level. It's also important in the U.S. And European context. Secretary Gates was reportedly very worried about the prospects that a larger U.S. footprint in Afghanistan would increase civilian casualties and fuel Afghan anger against the coalition. And his worries have been assuaged to some extent by McChrystal's focus and assumedly reassured by these recent numbers. They mean that the Afghan operation is now arguably the most precise counterinsurgent campaign in history. The vast majority of the deaths are now military. To give you some perspective on this, ISAF, that 7% figure, mean that ISAF caused 22 civilian deaths in August 2009. They suffered 76 casualties among their own forces. So this is what the metrics tell us. This is what this is assessing the strategy on its own terms. The deeper question, I suppose, is, will it work? Does it really matter? Will it generate support for the coalition mission and for the Afghan government? Civilian casualties as an issue clearly resonates very strongly here and in Europe. It's not clear that Afghans actually see this as a key issue. The violence that these numbers represents is actually fairly low, especially by the rather depressing standards set in Afghanistan in the last 30 years. For the sake of comparison, Ciudad Juarez, the Mexican border town next to El Paso, has had 1,700 murders this year in a population of 1.3 million people versus the 1,388 killed by violence in Afghanistan this year in a population of 32 million. The civilian casualty issue has certainly been highlighted by the Afghan government, but it, in part, I think that's because it serves to demonstrate their independence from the coalition and gives them leverage with the coalition. Local officials, in my experience, tend actually not to be too concerned with this to a degree, which is quite surprising to me. Indeed, the opposite. They tend to be focused not on casualties, but on control of the population. So, according to the Washington Post, when McChrystal went to apologize to Afghan local officials for the Kunduz incident that occurred at the beginning of September when some 30 to 50 civilians were killed, he was actually quite shocked by the reactions of the local officials. They weren't angry about the civilian casualties. They were angry that there hadn't been more attacks like this. One of them said, if we do three more operations like was done the other night, stability will come to Kunduz, one official told McChrystal. If people do not want to live in peace and harmony, that's not our fault. Another Afghan official, a governor of a province, called this policy stickocracy. What he meant was that control means that you are a provider of security and that you will do what is necessary to establish control. And the very attention that the coalition pays to civilian casualties actually creates the impression among many Afghans that they, in fact, are not interested in establishing control and not interested in being the provider of security. So arguably, this is a tension with a policy that emphasizes minimizing civilian casualties above all. But since that policy is working in terms of reducing deaths from coalition operations, as well as, frankly, could be expected, or better than could be expected. I guess we'll have to see how this tension works out. But that's just a sort of case study of the limits of metrics. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy, and everyone. Let's go straight to questions. As you can see, the overriding theme of our work here is we want to provide grist for debate. So please have at us and have at it. Yes, sir, let's start right here. And wait for the microphone. Please identify yourself, if you could.
Judd Herriot, documentary film producer. There's a metric on page 31 and 30 that fascinates me. On 31, it shows that 82% of the Pakistanis regard al-Qaeda as a critical threat. On the previous page, it shows that 59% of the Pakistanis share some or most of al-Qaeda's attitudes towards the U.S. Now, my question is, does this mean that the Pakistanis don't want al-Qaeda in their own house, but as long as they screw with the Americans, they're not bad fellows?
Bruce, you want to take that?
Yes. here, of course, though, one needs to be wary of polling data. How you present the question often leads to the answer that you get. But if you look at the polling data over the last 2 or 3 years, what has not changed is views about the United States and views about the righteousness of jihadism against the United States. What has changed is the perception that jihadism is now a threat to the interests of Pakistanis. So, in short, you've got it exactly right. If you want to bring down the World Trade Center, okay. If you want to attack the Crusaders in Afghanistan, okay. Don't blow up the Marriott Hotel. Don't kill our own leaders. But I would suggest to you, this is also part of a pattern we've seen in other countries in the Islamic world, where the first part of the blowback is almost all about don't do it here at home. What we've seen in places like Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt actually much earlier, back in the 1990s, is that there's a wave-like effect. People initially say, don't do it to citizens of my country, but it's okay to do it to American soldiers. Over time, they begin to also say, well, don't do it to American tourists in the souk, because we really want their dollars. But people do have a learning curve here, and the blowback from terrorism shouldn't be measured in one poll. It should be measured over a significant period of time.
Yes, sir. Let me take two in the front row together, and then we'll have responses.
Thank you. Raghu Virgo from India Global in Asia Today. My question is that a lot of assessment has been going on now in the White House, including today and this week more, and also at the Pentagon, and of course here at the Brookings, many meetings have taken place. Now, the problems in the area have been going on for the last 20 plus years, and now 9/11, 9 years. Many think tanks are saying that more military to Afghanistan may not solve the problem, but maybe much more pressure on Pakistan. My question is, how much pressure can you put more on Pakistan than what they are doing now, and what you think will be the outcome of this problem?
And sir, please. Actually, we'll take two more, and then we'll go.
Yeah. My name is Kami Bhatt. I write for the Pakistani Spectator. My question to Mr. Cohen is that normally in the media we see that, like, everything that goes on against America and NATO in Afghanistan is the work of Mullah Umar. Mullah Umar, how many division of army he has in Quetta? If he is in Pakistan, probably he is sleeping in different houses like Saddam Hussein. So my question to you is this, is that our disappointment that somehow we are unable to court Pakhtun population of Afghanistan, and because of that disappointment, we tend to blame everything to Pakistan because it's accommodating Mullah Umar. I do not know if Pakistan is accommodating Mullah Umar. And then my question about American perception, like Jason, you said that Pakistan is one of the very few Muslim countries that are Obama-proof. And I think the reason I would ask this question to Bruce, that how can we expect some good wishes from those Muslim or from those Pakistanis when we are supporting a guy who is internationally known, Mr. 10%. And if you know, if you have, I'm sure that you have read the book of Hussain Haqqani, the current Pakistani ambassador in Washington. He is the one who fed Washington that problem in India, Sri Lanka, Nepal are created by ISI, designed by Pakistani army and implemented by ISI. When he is not, no wonder that he is known as a political prostitute among Pakistani American community. If we have this kind of person in Washington who has done so much harm to Pakistan, and then we are supporting Mr. 10%, I mean, President Obama was dallying with Nawaz Sharif when we wanted Pakistani army to go after those troublemakers. But beyond that, we don't support the leader who have some good wishes among Pakistani people like Imran Khan or Nawaz Sharif. We are still supporting this Mr. 10%, whose whole objective is to take poor Pakistani's dollar and deposit it into his personal account. Thanks.
And then just behind. Well, first in the second row, and then we'll come back here. So we'll have four questions for four panelists, please.
Yes, my question is, first, my name is Abdul Wajid Adil from the Voice of America Afghanistan Service. Many Afghans, they always complain that that still ISI is involved in dealing with Taliban in Afghanistan. Just today, there was some press report that some people call Afghan Taliban actually are the free army of Pakistan. Because Pakistan will never abandon Afghanistan's interest because they consider long-term interest in Pakistan in Afghanistan. So this is one thing that I would like to say, that why there is not much pressure on ISI in particular to stop interfering in Afghanistan. The second thing is the perception of Pashtuns is not reflected in this index. Pashtun populations of Afghanistan and Pakistan, they have different perceptions regarding the situations in Swat, in Waziristan, and other areas. And this should be considered in the index. Thank you.
Thank you. And then we'll wrap up here for this round, right in the front.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, I'm Rajesh Karian. I've done some writing on South Asia. We talked of Swat as the first operation, but perhaps the metrics where you can get the most information on reconstruction and displacement is Bajor. And it's an isolated area, and I wonder whether you've looked at that. The second thing was about 10,000 military casualties. I don't think that 10,000 hospital beds under Pakistan Army control. So are these going to civilian hospitals? That may be a way of measuring that the casualties sustained. The third, and I'll just finish off, how many violently dead in Tokyo?
Okay, so why don't we just run down the line and take whichever questions you like, please.
Yeah, I'll deal with the first and possibly the third question. I think it's wrong to assume that states and their leaders are the same as mules and donkeys. That is, the carrot and stick approach strikes me as self-defeating. If you want to have influence, you've got to persuade the leadership of a country, whether you like them or not, that it's in their interest, in their country's interest, to pursue a particular policy. So I think in that case, we have a lot going for us in the case of Pakistan. I think Pakistanis are at another crossroads. It's one intersection after another for them, where they've got to make a decision about their future. And if they want to be the kind of country that people hate and distrust and characterize as the source of all terrorism, they could do that. It'd be very easy. Plus, they'd have nuclear weapons. But I think if they want to be a country that can accommodate their neighbors, live peacefully, have something that resembles a democracy at home, they could probably do that also. So I think that's the kind of argument we should be making with Pakistanis, which we are, I think, in this administration in particular, and provide whatever means we can provide to them so they can carry this out. So the notion of carrots and sticks sanctions strikes me as the wrong way to approach the leaders of another country. In the case of Mullah Omar and so forth, I think it's remarkable that and what we're doing about Pakistani support for the Taliban. I think the McChrystal report is astonishing. It was the most explicit, detailed analysis of what Pakistan is doing with Taliban that I've ever seen. And since that was cleared all the way up the chain of command, I would assume that the Pakistanis are in deep conversation with American leaders, and especially military leaders, about whether they're going to get X amount of equipment unless they don't stop supporting people like the Taliban. So I think there's probably an argument being made here that it's in your interest not to support these people, and that it's not in your interest to see the Taliban as a projection of Pakistani power into Central Asia. I think that's false geopolitics on Pakistan's part.
Sorry, I got to be a tough guy on this.
Collective advisor.
Jeremy, please.
Thank you. I would say on the issue that Steve was just talking about, we had a lot of debates on the McChrystal assessment of a lot of different issues, and we tended not to agree on most things. The issue of the Pakistani assistance was not an issue that we disagreed on. In terms of the sort of relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan, I think there's an Afghan dimension to the drone attacks, which maybe often gets underestimated. There, in addition to trying to limit the capacity of the insurgent groups in Afghanistan, those drone attacks are very important for Afghan public opinion. The Afghan perception, rightly or wrongly, is that this is a war that stems from Pakistan. And one of the things that sends to confuse them about this war is, if the war stems from Pakistan, why is it taking place in Afghanistan? They say, if when you ask Afghans, well, what should our policy be? Should we be bombing more should we be fighting more in Afghanistan? They say, no, you should be fighting more in Pakistan. You should be bombing more in Pakistan. Strikes me as a fairly bloodthirsty policy, but is pretty unanimous. And so the drone attacks are an important way, although I think they have a lot of, I certainly agree that they have a lot of the negatives that have been alluded to. They're an important way of actually demonstrating to the Afghan population that, in fact, the coalition recognizes that. I think that the other comment that went to me is about the question about Tokyo, I guess. Is that what you said, Tokyo? Yeah. I think this comes down to a question of societal standards of violence. We have much higher levels of violence in Washington, D.C. than we have than they have in Tokyo, but we managed to accept it. And I think what we haven't done very well in Afghanistan, or in terms of the U.S. military, really anywhere, is sort of try to understand what this violence means in the context of the given society. It means something very different in Tokyo, in Washington, in Kabul, or in Kandahar.
Let me pile on to a couple of things here. First of all, the question of pressure on Pakistan over the Afghan Taliban. The McChrystal report, as we have it, is a remarkable document. I've never seen a leaked document that was redacted. We have a document here which the Pentagon went back to the Post on and said, we want to take out these things, therefore we want to leave in these things. And leaving in the stuff about the relationship between Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban could not have been an oversight. They must have known what that was going to mean, and I think that's a very good example, as Steve suggested, of putting pressure on the government of Pakistan. Publicity works. That gets to the question about Pakistani casualties. I don't know what hospitals they're in. What I know is this. Over the last week, we suddenly got a number from the government of Pakistan as to how many army casualties it suffered in the war against the Taliban. And it was really quite precise. I don't have the exact number. It was like 5,392 killed, 10,000 such and such wounded. This did not look to be a number that was made up out of whole cloth. Someone came up with a great deal of precision. A lot more data like that would be very helpful to persuading people on the outside what it is that Pakistan is actually doing. So I applaud the notion of putting it out there, and what I would urge them to do is put a lot more of that kind of data out there. Over what period? Over how long? Where did they go? What hospitals? How many were killed and wounded in various places? This is indicative of something else we've seen in the last few months. The ISI, like most intelligence organizations, is usually not terribly friendly to the media. They don't like to talk to the media. All of a sudden, this summer, the ISI has become very friendly with the media. Look at David Ignatius's piece in the Washington Post yesterday. That was a remarkable effort on their part to reach out and try and deal with some of the criticisms of it. I thought David was a little bit soft in how he portrayed the responses, but that's his business of being a correspondent. Now, opening up to the media doesn't mean you've changed your policies. But it does suggest that you recognize you have a problem, and that's the first step. Recognition that you have some kind of a problem is a good thing to have happen. Now we'd like to see a lot more activity, a lot more data, and not just because we want it for the Pakistan Index. We all want to see it to see a more transparency in Pakistani policy. The question of support for different individuals in the Pakistani government, I think this administration wisely at the beginning of its term decided it wasn't going to pick favorites in Pakistani politics. First of all, the history of the United States picking favorites in foreign governments' politics is one of universal disaster. We should never pick foreign leaders. We almost always pick the wrong guy. And in any case, it's not up to us. The United States government, contrary to all the conspiracy theories you will read in the Pakistani press, is not going to decide who the next president of Pakistan is. Some group of Pakistanis, probably unfortunately not the majority of Pakistanis, will decide that, not the United States government.
Sure, just a couple of quick points. Sir, with regard to your question about the Pashtun perception in both Pakistan and Afghanistan, I don't dispute that at all, that there's certainly going to be a discrepancy between their perceptions and some of the, you know, Punjabis or Tajiks or Uzbeks or whoever else in either country. But again, we're beholden here to open source data, and it's just a matter of not having seen or come across such polling data that broke it down either by ethnicity or as Steve referred to, educational background. And either one of those would certainly be welcome. And you know, we're very open when people contact us with a better source. We're usually pretty quick to include it as part of the index project. So if you know of any or if anyone does, we'd certainly be happy to consider it. And the other, with regard to Bajor displacement, and actually it is a pretty interesting, that district in the most recent OCHA weekly update report on Pakistan displacement had a very interesting chart that we depict in the index that shows the overall population displacement over this last 8 or 10 month period, given the added in security. And it estimated that for Bajor, about 90% of that population of that district has at least at one point been displaced. So that's certainly the highest of any of the specific districts that we're looking at. And it's certainly a key indicator that has experienced some certainly heightened insecurity. And we're trying to get, a better grasp of that going forward to try to track these over time to see sort of the which way the arrows are pointing on a given week-to-week basis.
Bruce had a previous commitment, so he's going to have to go. So there's going to be one more question for Bruce, and then we'll do another mega round after he's left. Who has a question for Bruce, if I could? We'll go here. And then, Gary, you'll get the first one in the next round.
First of all, I think this is a very good exercise. My observation was there was one thing missing, which if could be included. That's about the number of madrasas, because these madrasas, they have been part of Pakistan's educational system for a very long time. In the past, there were very few. But with the passage of time, especially during war against Soviet Union, the number of madrasas have risen. Now, these madrasas may not be producing militants outrightly, but they are producing a mindset where you will find a lot of hatred against those people who doesn't profess Islam and that sort of things. So that if number of madrasas, whether they are on increase or they are on decline, that should be a sort of very good. Okay. aspect.
That's probably more for Jason. So I'm going to ask you to pass to Gary, and then we'll have, if you have one for Bruce, we'll finish up that way. He's got to literally go now.
And I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Ali. I'm a Fulbright scholar at American University.
Thank you. Please.
I think I'll ask it quickly. What is or what are the most important metrics that we don't know, that we can't measure?
Well, I think all of us will probably have some. I have a really simple one: location data. Where is the center of gravity of the enemy? Where are their headquarters? That kind of data is absolutely critical. When Eisenhower and Montgomery crossed the channel in June 1944, they tried to have the most data they could about the location of the enemy. We have very weak data here. The drone attacks demonstrate the first real development of real hard data about enemy locations. But even there, it's almost all about Al-Qaeda. What's amazing to me is that 8 years after this war has started, the amount of in-depth intelligence we have on the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, is very weak. We can't even give you an authoritative answer to the question, how important is Mullah Omar anymore? I think he's very important, but I don't think the data isn't there. We have not devoted, either as a government nor as think tanks, as much effort to studying the enemy we're actually fighting on the battlefield as we should have over the last 8 years.
Thank you, Bruce. As you're signing off, why don't we ask Jason to address the madrasas question, and then we'll go to a final round. And Steve, you may want to comment on that, too, I realize.
Sure. With regard to the madrasas, that's an excellent point, and one that we do have in mind. Obviously, again, this is an ever-evolving study that is updated on a very regular basis, and that is an important component. One thing that I've, again, Mike and I come into this not as Pakistani experts, but more from the sort of counterinsurgency and trying to measure progress over the broad areas of that need improvement for stability. So that being said, trying to discern now, you have, from what I understand, the government official madrasas, you have some unofficial madrasas. I've come across some studies that try to look at the broad numbers, and that's something that we'll certainly do continue to do going forward. And once we have enough of some of the data holes plugged in and are able to put together a concise chart or graph, it'll certainly be part of the added to the index.
Steve, anyway.
Yeah, I agree that the government itself doesn't exactly know how many madrasas there are. So some people simply refuse to register. I think what's more important, though, is what's going on between the ears of the students in the madrasas, as well as in the elite universities of Pakistan. What are the 19 and 20 year old people think, young men and women, think about their future? Do they think that they have a future in Pakistan? Do they think Pakistan has a future? What do they think is wrong with the country? What is right with the country? We have no data on that whatsoever.
So we'll take three or four more questions and then conclude. Why don't we begin this time in the far back row? And there are two hands in the far back row, and then I'll move up a little bit.
Thanks, Mike. It's Indira Lakshman from Bloomberg News. And this question is actually for a piece I'm doing for the International Herald Tribune. I wanted to ask Jeremy about Afghanistan, since you've had the opportunity to advise General McChrystal, and we didn't get in so much to the Afghan metrics. Specifically, the big thing hanging over this in one way is the election and the widespread allegations of fraud, and what is the United States going to do in the aftermath of this election? How is it going to deal with, I guess, presumably the Karzai government if he's reelected? So I'd really like to hear that part of the metrics. What's your perception of what the good choices are available to the U.S. and the international community going forward in the civil part of U.S. involvement there? Thanks.
And then over here, also in the back row, please. Then we'll move up.
I'm Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. The attack this past weekend, several hundred, 200 to 300 Taliban congregated, yet nobody came forward from the local community to warn our people, to warn the Afghans, who were also attacked in a separate base, some of them captured. Why do you think nobody came forward to warn either us or the Afghan forces?
Tough question. Over here on the side, please, and then I'll come back to the middle.
It's Dana Marshall with Dewey and LaBeouf. I have sort of 1.5 questions. First question is, what does all of this, these performance measures, really imply in terms of how we ought to be allocating the $1.5 billion times 5 years that was just voted last week? The half question is, I think about a year or so ago, the IRI did a kind of an interesting poll where they asked what single thing, if the United States did that, would help basically improve your image of the United States. Did you think about that kind of polling? Do you have anything, any update on that?
Here in the middle, please. No, yeah, on my right.
Hi, Vijay Sangren from Dome Advisors. I had a quick question. There has been reports that on the ground that the U.S. Embassy is being made into a green zone in Islamabad. Is there any comments on that?
Okay, and I think because everyone's being a model of efficiency and conciseness, we do have time if our panelists can keep all these questions in mind for one more. So we'll go, yes, please, near the back.
I'm Farwa Zafar, civil society member from Pakistan, political analyst. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to stick to one brief
Thank
one. Part of it was questioned already. As we speak just now and the debate continues on securing Pakistan, Afghanistan strategies, the Kerry Lugar bill, I can't help to ask that there is a growing response in Pakistan that this bill is very conditional. It seeks to control Pakistan's nuclear program, foreign policy, and serve.
Hold the mic to your
interest.
Mouth, please.
And this has been voiced even in Parliament in the last few days since it's come up. So what I want to know is that I feel there's a three-theater threat calculus in Pakistan: uncertainty, insecurity, fear, mistrust, interaction towards the U.S. on these areas. So do you feel this Kerry Lugar bill is really going to pacify these areas of concern, and also how your index today, I still have to get a copy, so I have to look at it, is going to be maybe used as a source of certification by the Secretary of State, which is required, and do other such aid bills also compare it to other countries with such conditionalities?
Thank you. That's about 7.5 questions for three panelists, but they're good enough to handle them. So in this case, why don't we again start with Steve and then work down to Jason.
Yeah, let me deal with your last question and comment. I think that this administration takes seriously the question of opinion in Pakistan and other countries, and I think that they understand much better than the Bush administration. How do you do this? In the Bush administration, we were profoundly hated by Pakistanis for supporting what eventually became an incompetent military regime. So we had both no competence from the Pakistan government and popular dislike of the U.S. I think that they're bent on using this $1.5 billion times five aid package to not only improve the fate of Pakistanis, but to improve our image in Pakistan. That's less important, in fact, than simply improving Pakistan as a state and as a society. So, and the president's speech in Cairo has been mentioned to be by several Pakistanis, a number of Pakistanis, as an important breakthrough in terms of American expression of its concern about the Islamic world. And I know that the White House is following up the Cairo speech with specific programs for a whole range of what they call Muslim-majority countries. So, yes, there's a problem in terms of public opinion. No, I don't think it's a short-term problem. It's a long-term phenomenon. But I think that it's being addressed by this administration much better than the previous administration.
Sir.
Okay, thanks for those hard questions. In terms of the question of why did nobody warn the U.S. forces, I certainly don't know in this particular incident. We have a somewhat similar incident from last year in roughly the same region. And the story there is a fairly typical one, and I wouldn't be surprised to see this one corresponding to that story. The U.S. forces in that province, in Nuristan, sit astride smuggling routes from Pakistan, essentially, particularly opium smuggling routes, but basically they'll smuggle anything. And they very frequently, sometimes without even trying, disrupt those smuggling routes. That's to some degree part of their mandate. And so it's in that area they have tended to be very unpopular for reasons that they don't entirely understand, for reasons which actually have very little to do with the overall ideological battle of why we're in Afghanistan or the Taliban versus the government or anything like that. And they also tend to vary quite a bit from valley to valley as the U.S. forces become, to some degree by virtue of their position, but also to some degree for reasons that they don't understand, instrumentalized in local feuds that have mostly to do with smuggling and other local issues. And so when they come on the wrong side of that, as they often do, they end up being very disenfranchised from the population. So you end up with examples in Nuristan in particular. This is true to some degree throughout Afghanistan, particularly in Nuristan, where the U.S. will be able to walk without body armor through the bazaar of one village, and the next valley over will be in constant combat. And so I'm guessing that this was the latter example.
I think also this unit was about to be redeployed out of where it was at, and it was really the old strategy, not the new strategy. Is that correct, Jeremy?
It's at least the implication of the new strategy, yeah. I don't know about this particular unit, though. In terms of the election, I think it's fair to say that the election result is a real disaster for U.S. policy. So what do our metrics tell us about it? Not very much. What good choices are left? There's clearly no good choices. As a matter of fact, it's clearly, to some degree, the worst of all possible worlds. They went into the election in a way that was determined to challenge Hamid Karzai, in a way that was determined to distance them from him. They succeeded in that, but they didn't succeed in dislodging him. So all they have is a much worse relationship with the government, a sense among the population that the government is yet more illegitimate, and of course the overall impression of the population in Afghanistan, who never believed that this election would come out in any other way than the Americans wanted, is that in fact they have sustained Hamid Karzai. This is really the worst of all possible worlds. What will they do? I think that the evidence for that seems quite clear, because I don't think there are many choices. The one official who was advocating in the U.S. government or in the international community, who was advocating taking a strong line against the election fraud, was Peter Galbraith, who now finds himself without a job and doesn't seem to have been supported by even the patrons that put him into that position, Richard Holbrook in particular, as far as I can tell. So that seems to me to show a fairly clear direction. I don't really think there's much choice. There are no other options for the U.S. There is no capacity to challenge this result or to find anybody else who could take up this government.
Sure. I'm just going to say one word myself as I pass things over to Jason for the final word. And I agree with Jeremy, but I also think that, you know, right now we're having the Washington debate about future Afghanistan policy somewhat oversimplified, but still perhaps somewhat accurately described as a debate between two camps, the go minimal, go small counterterrorism concept and the McChrystal approach. And what I actually think is the more interesting debate, since I think the counterterrorism approach has already been discredited by 6 years of trying that under Rumsfeld, effectively, is an approach in which you try to leverage any additional American commitment to get the Afghans to do more and do better. That's not going to be an easy to describe option. It's not going to be a bargain where we all write down on a contract what we'll do and what they'll do. As Steve and Jeremy have been emphasizing, there are too many sovereign sensibilities and sensitivities for the Kabul government to be willing to have that kind of a contract. But I think we have to try to use this moment of leverage to get them to do as much as we plausibly can. And that's where more of the American debate, in my judgment, should be going right now. Again, it's a nuanced, indirect way of exercising influence. It's not as simple or easy to describe as, you know, CT versus COIN, counterterrorism versus counterinsurgency, but I think it's a more meaningful set of choices, and I hope we see more of that kind of a framing of the issue in the coming weeks. If I were advising Mr. Obama, I think that's what he's got to try to think about how to do. Any more additional American commitment to the war has to be, to the extent possible, used to leverage a greater Afghan commitment. Jason's going to wrap up here. I was glad some of the questions emphasized economics. And there are a number of things he's doing in the index that we'll continue to do here that try to give us the basis to document future progress. Everything from watching how many cell phones people use province by province in Afghanistan, if we can get that data. And Steve's right to focus on breaking down trends province by province. To trends in how people use the internet, believe it or not. Admittedly, not every 11-year-old schoolgirl in South Waziristan is online. But nonetheless, there actually are internet centers in the Fatah. And you can actually go onto a Google function and figure out what people are searching, what's on their mind. It's almost an indirect form of polling and an indirect form of measuring how they feel about certain realities in their lives. We've talked about trying to gin up our own polling operation in some of these areas, which we haven't yet figured out how to do, but it's on our mind. Anyway, there are a lot of things, and the Pakistanis are doing a nice job in a lot of their documents, which are available online for those of you who want to see the primary data yourselves. And I think it's a pretty honest effort to track what they know about what's going on in a number of these areas. And we'll, of course, continue to work with them on those fronts. But Jason, I apologize for keeping you, but I would love to hear your final thoughts on any of the questions that are still on the agenda.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick point on Stanley's question regarding the attack in Nuristan province. And in that situation, we have made it publicly known that we are on our way out of that area. It is no longer a strategic priority. And I think that small example is somewhat indicative of one of the bigger questions we have to deal with in the region, and that is, you know, why is the ISI continue to have such close ties with certain elements of the Taliban and al-Qaeda? Why is it difficult to get Pashtun villages in certain areas of Afghanistan to put some trust in us? And this shows that, you know, it was no longer a worry for these people in Nuristan that, you know, well, we need to hedge our bets, the Americans might leave. It's the Americans are now leaving, and how can we expect them to stick their necks out on the line knowing that we are on our way out and they're going to be left with the residual Taliban forces there? So I think we need to be cognizant of, you know, just going forward, and I don't want to over-extrapolate here, but, you know, in making announcements that you're leaving and sort of getting rid of the doubt in people's minds, you're going to have a very difficult time in trying to engender a trust among the local populations. And unfortunately, I think this is an attack like what happened in Nuristan is in some ways was predictable. Because you just can't expect to have local cooperation, given that you're telling them you're going to leave them to the Taliban, you know, in the coming weeks.
Let me just say, this is Jeremy putting on his analyst hat. We all do this as we do the indexes. We try to both present data and then interpret it. We try to sort of honestly create a firewall in our brains so that our policy judgments aren't influencing the data and vice versa. Again, you all will keep us honest, we hope, and ideas are welcome. Thank you very much for being here today. We appreciate it.